2022 is promising some big developments in clean, green energy. Topping the list, electric cars.
11 new electric vehicles coming in 2022. In the upcoming years, electric cars will take over those with internal combustion engines. From big companies to new startups, rushing headlong to promise more models ranging from cars to pickups to make sure that everyone can choose.
Now, electric vehicles have lower CO2 emissions than gas-fueled rides, so these new electric options feel like a straightforward environmental win. But it's more complicated than that. See, electric cars run on batteries. Batteries powered by elemental metals like lithium and nickel. And extracting lithium and nickel from the earth isn't clean or green. It's filthy. It's ruinous. And it's highly lucrative. Yeah, you know where this is going. As American car preferences shift from gas to electric, last decade's chant of drill, baby, drill has transformed to mine that hill. In Nevada, the Bureau of Land Management leased more than 5,000 acres of federal land to Lithium Americas for an open pit lithium mine. And the proposed site threatens waterways, fish, and wildlife. Another vast pit mine in Arizona, proposed by Perpetua Resources, poses similar threats. And both projects also run afoul of tribal sovereignty. In Nevada, tribes in the Fort McDermitt Indian Reservation have protested the lithium mine out of concern about potential degradation of community water sources. And in Arizona, tribes have raised concerns about the desecration of burial grounds. Similar struggles are going on in Idaho, Alaska, and New Mexico. Exploding dormant volcanoes, extracting irreplaceable resources, and violating indigenous land is not exactly a sustainable green revolution. Nick Estes is a citizen of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe and host of the Red Nation podcast. He'll be joining the American Indian Studies Department at the University of Minnesota later this year. He joined the Takeaway to discuss the ways mining is affecting indigenous communities.
Mining is, you know, historically been part of the way that indigenous land has been targeted for dispossession, but also desired by corporations. You know, for example, the place where I come from, which is called Hesapa or the Black Hills, was part of a very bloody and long war with the United States government over the gold reserves that it held. You know, of course, we know that it produced, like, I think it was 10% of the world's gold supply and stands at the kind of crux of a larger struggle for land back for indigenous people. And even the United States Supreme Court ruled that the Black Hills was taken illegally. And so in many ways, mining has been at the heart of the indigenous struggle for not just land back, but for justice in this country. But it's also the way that the United States has built its wealth off the backs of indigenous people. And we're seeing that. I think we think of extractive industries and indigenous communities in terms of the fossil fuel industry, which is incredibly important. But also, you know, with this green energy revolution that's happening right now, we have what are called critical minerals or strategic minerals that are necessary for green renewable technology, things such as copper, cobalt, and now lithium. And now we see kind of a new round of dispossession and targeting of indigenous lands as containing these necessary minerals for this transition.
Go back a year when President Biden kills the Keystone Pipeline project. Much of how the pipeline was described, thought about, understood was passing over land rather than being extracted from it. So maybe you connect that a bit for me.
Yeah, well, I think we might have to go back a little further into the Obama presidency and looking at the beginning of the fracking revolution that really, you know, launched the United States as, you know, the number one oil producer in the world, but also how Obama's strategic plan of developing America's energy independence, as he called it, really relied on developing domestic oil supply. And that was through fracking. I remember back in 2008, 2009, when this really began, there was all these reports of, you know, coming out from places like the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in North Dakota, that was experiencing this immense fracking boom, the violence that it was happening in the communities and the influx of oil workers and, you know, this kind of like new frontier mentality, we can really kind of criticize the administration that came in after him. But in reality, a lot of the policies that Trump really expanded in his, you know, what he called American energy dominance, was really just picking up the processes that were started under the Obama administration and really developing the oil and gas in the domestic context. It's also important to remember that Obama gave a speech at the southern leg of the pipeline, really celebrating the completion of the Keystone XL pipeline. So really what Biden did, you know, was reverse a Trump era decision, really going back to the Obama era. But that wasn't, you know, we have to put that into context because the American energy independence program or policy that Obama was really promoting was expanded under Trump. You know, we have to think about how this country's economy, especially when it comes to energy, really comes on the backs of indigenous people. Native lands have also possessed the energy materials that this country needs to function. And it goes beyond just, you know, oil and gas. It goes down to things such as uranium. If we look back to the 70s under the Nixonian era of, you know, sacrifice zones of looking to the West of like, you know, we're going to sacrifice this area for America's energy supplies because it contains large deposits of oil or coal or uranium. But it's also important to remember that in this era of, you know, national sacrifice zones, that the most bombed place by nuclear weapons is the Four Corners region of Utah, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico, where this kind of triangle of uranium production, mining, enrichment, and testing, whether it's nuclear weapons or for energy, has taken place. We have to remember that there are like consequences to these so-called green energy revolution, like or clean energy revolutions, as they have, you know, permeated through American history. And even going back to my homelands, the idea that, you know, hydroelectricity was a form of clean energy had deleterious consequences for my nation. We were flooded twice by two hydroelectric dams. And so when we think about the Obama era, the Trump era, and the Biden era of meeting America's energy demands, we have to ask ourselves, at whose expense does it come that we maintain the levels of consumption of the United States when it comes to energy?
One thing is, in fact, historic and different in this moment under this administration, and it is the Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland. What difference has it made for her to be in this role?
I think it's important that somebody like Deb Haaland has, you know, the authority at a cabinet level within, you know, the Biden administration. But it's, you know, it's the same issues that I think the Black community felt with somebody like, you know, Obama in power, is that it's like you can change the face of the system, but the system in many ways will function the same way. And, you know, it's not to say that there aren't opportunities and possibilities that are created through Deb Haaland being in that position. But it's also to say that historically, you know, the Department of Interior has served as the handmaiden of indigenous dispossession. I mean, even just going back to Trump's administration, we can, you know, we can kind of like be aghast at how it was just stocked from top to bottom with oil and gas and, you know, extractive industries people. And it's also no coincidence that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is in the same department in the federal government as land management and wildlife management, right? We have never transcended beyond kind of our place in terms of our relationship to minerals and, you know, resources, quote unquote, natural resources. Deb Haaland probably more so than anyone understands that contradiction, right? That there's only so much that one person can do when you're working against more than a century of history that has, you know, dispossessed indigenous people and that has mismanaged indigenous lands and resources. And so in that sense, I think we need to be a little bit more realistic in terms of understanding the possibilities of a Haaland administration, because we can look now at like such something like the Line 3 pipeline struggle, which is, you know, is still going on actually here in Minnesota, where I'm calling you from. And you had a lieutenant governor, Peggy Flanagan, who is from the White Earth Indian Reservation here in the state. You also had the acting secretary of the Army Corps of Engineers, who was Jamie Pinkham, who was from the Nez Perce Indian Reservation. And then also you had Deb Holland, who was at, you know, the cabinet level for Department Secretary of Department of Interior. You have three Indigenous people at, like, you know, the state level as well as the federal level. We would expect that they would do more than not do anything or say anything publicly about this really controversial pipeline, right? Because it is, you know, the Biden administration canceled Keystone XL pipeline, much to the celebration and, you know, gratitude of Indigenous nations who had been opposing building a tar sands, dirty tar sands pipeline through their homelands. But what is Line 3? Line 3 is a reroute and a tar sands pipeline that's going to be transporting some of the same oil that was slotted for transportation through the Keystone XL pipeline, right? We have to ask ourselves what is really changing and what has changed.
Even if there isn't a clear path to the kinds of alterations in power that we need to see, nonetheless, maybe it's worth just taking a few moments to talk about what is required to ensure that Indigenous voices, that community-based decision making is in fact central. I'm so struck. I'm still processing a bit this notion of Native peoples as simply land use or animal resource.
The federal government is still like viewing us essentially as a resource / animal population that can be managed. And if you think about that, we didn't elect, I'm not trying to be critical of Deb Holland here, but we didn't elect her, right? But yet she holds so much authority over Indigenous lands and lives that if you got somebody, we're lucky in many ways to have her, but if you got somebody in the past who is, antagonistic or fundamentally opposed to tribal sovereignty, you can imagine what kind of effect that has on us, right? And so in that sense, it's not a democratic system, and it hasn't been. It's fundamentally colonial, right? It is the definition of colonialism. It's an imposed form of political governance, right? So that's one way to think about it. And the other way to think about it is that we are living in the era of the water protector. The IEN report, the Indigenous Environmental Network report, says that Indigenous movements have challenged 25% of carbon emissions from Canada and the United States. This should be front page headline on the New York Times and on every major newspaper, that a minority of minority population is posing such a great threat to the fossil fuel industry, one of the most powerful industries in the world. But it's not just being against something, right? The water, being a water protector, as far as I understood it from talking to water protectors in my research and, you know, being from a family of water protectors in many ways, is that it's not just about being opposed to something, but it's about being for something. And we can look at the Line 3 camps that came up here in northern Minnesota. We can look at the Standing Rock camps that happened, you know, in to oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, north of the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. And you can say that, like, everyone who walked through those gates and, you know, went to those camps, whether they were Indigenous or not, became a water protector and were part of those movements in some ways. And so this idea that somehow saving the planet, stopping pipelines, you know, providing an alternative land ethic is somehow a quote unquote Indigenous problem is completely unfounded by the actual facts of, you know, what's happening on the ground. To understand that you're not just opposing a pipeline, but you're standing, you know, in defense of future generations. And in many ways, the ethic of a water protector is to be a good ancestor to the future. And I think that is much more hopeful than, you know, what is currently on offer right now. And I think it also throws into question the levels of consumption that are required to maintain the lifestyle that many of us aspire to in the United States. And thinking about success and development doesn't have to mean consumption, but can mean other things. It can mean reconnecting and redeveloping and strengthening our relationship to the land itself, but then also reconnecting and making good relations with each other as human beings with the non-human world. And I think that's really what's on offer and at stake. We can't also ignore how the state, not just Minnesota, but the state, you know, capital S, has responded to these movements and criminalizing them, but also this push to undermine kind of the very fabric of tribal sovereignty as a legal superstructure that requires protection by the federal government in things such as the Indian Child Welfare Act, right? You have you have corporate law firms that represent, you know, Chevron and Shell, who are attacking something as benign, seemingly benign as Indian child welfare and the protection of indigenous children from being adopted out or taken away from their families. So these are the stakes. Like they're not kind of benign processes that are happening. You have some of the most dispossessed people in this country facing down some of the most powerful people in the world. And I think that should give us a little bit of hope, because there's been a lot of success in that field.
Nick Estes, host of the Red Nation podcast, he'll be joining the American Indian Studies Department at the University of Minnesota later this year. Nick, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.